doing it, he's like, well, you have a choice. You can either speak on what you want to, you can pick your topic, or I can pick it for you. And I thought, this will be interesting. You know what? Okay, what? Pick my topic. What am I going to be speaking on? And as he was saying, in the back of my head, I thought, you know what is going to be the hardest sermon to ever do is the sermon on Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I thought that's going to be the hardest sermon to ever preach because they've been a part of our VBSs forever. And so as he talks, he says, well, we're doing this narrative, we're doing this story, and this Sunday, it's going to be on Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I thought, great, give me the most complicated lesson to ever do. Because I've read through this story, like you, 1,000 times. I've got it memorized. I know the ending. I know what happens to Daniel. I know what happens to his 3 friends. I know that they end up winning. So how could we possibly look at this differently? How could we as a congregation read through these stories and get anything new out of it? But before we start, as you guys have been going through this story of the entire Bible, which I love, I am such a big fan of this. I think congregations do not do this enough. And that is look at the Bible as a story, as a narrative, going from the beginning to the very end and then plugging yourself into the middle of it and asking yourself some pretty serious questions like, where do I belong? How do I fit into the Psalms? How do I fit into the gospel in that extremely mysterious Leviticus? Do I even try and read those books? Aren't they just a bunch of boring laws? The answer is yes, they are full of boring laws. They are. I mean, and I love people who, when they first, when they're brought into Christ and they're so excited, and they say, man, I want to read the entire Bible. I'm going to start in Exodus. I said, whoa, hold on. Take it easy. You're going to get to Deuteronomy and you're going to fall away because you're going to think, can anything be this boring? And it is. It's rough. You know, go through the Gospel of John. Go through anything. Just don't start at the beginning. So I love this concept of where do I fit? And so as you guys know, the Jews are in exile. And before we go any further, you guys have to know something. And that is the importance of the temple of God. Now, in Jewish culture, the temple was everything. It was the center of education. It was the center of culture. It was the center of communication. It was the center of everything about their government. Now, and I was racking my brain and I was asking myself, what is the modern equivalent of the Jewish temple? If I had to pick something about the United States of America, where we're at, or even just the churches of Christ, what could I point at and say, all right, that is our equivalent of the Jewish temple? And the only thing that I could think of, and I kept saying it in my mind, and I kept saying, no, this can't be it. It cannot be like this. But for some reason, I can think of no other thing. And that is our cell phones. When you look at it and you say, what is the modern equivalent of the Jewish temple? My mind keeps going to cell phones. Now, everybody take out your cell phone. This is going to be an experiment for everybody. Take out your cell phones and raise them in the air. Raise them in the air. Yes, look at that. More and more. Yes, my 75-year-old grandmother has a cell phone that she spams me with every day. I don't know who taught her how to do that, but I get cute cat pictures every week. And as awesome as they are, and as great as tools as they are, I mean, I was Skyping with my mother on my phone to her phone. How crazy is that? You know, when I went to school, when I went through Sunset, I remember email was still kind of questionable. Like, really, should we be getting into email? I mean, that's like electronic communication with anybody. You know, why can't we just write letters? Now, today, the only letter I get is from my grandma. And I love that. I love when I get a letter from her. But I was thinking about the cell phone is the center of our culture. It's the center of our communication. We carry it around with us everywhere. What else do you carry in your pocket that you carry as much as your cell phone? Your wallet, credit cards, the things that are most important to you. You know, there was a study done, and I strongly encourage you to do this. And I'm not saying that this is the devil, all right? There are very good reasons why we should have this. There was an article, and I forget what paper it was. I think it was Newsweek or Time. And they polled a bunch of teenagers and college students. And they asked them a bunch of questions. One of the tests they did was they sat them down in a room and they showed them pictures of their parents. And then they also had that big, enormous brain cap on and monitoring their brain waves. And when they were showing them pictures of their grandma, their grandparents, their parents, it was activating parts of their brain that showed love. And then they showed them pictures of their Facebook page and their cell phone, and it activated the same part of their brain. When they asked kids, like, what happens? What do you feel like when you leave your cell phone at home? And what this really blew me away. They were using words like naked. They felt naked. They felt incomplete, like something was wrong. They were constantly looking in their pockets for something that wasn't there. So when I look at this and I say, what in the Jewish culture can I bring over? I have to sincerely say the cell phone. It's become an important part of our lives. And just as our cell phone is important to us, this Jewish temple was their direct line, their communication to what was important. They could not talk to God without this temple. And you have to know that the original plan of God is when the Jewish people would come into the promised land, that the tabernacle would travel throughout the land. So it would travel from province to province, from tribe to tribe. It would go north to Dan, and then it would go south to Judah. And the people would be able to go and actually talk and be in the presence of their God. Can you imagine how amazing that would be? To know that in your regular life, in order to come face to face with God, I have to go to this tabernacle. I have to go to this beautiful structure. And I know that in there, that's my God. So when these Jews are in exile, you have to be in their mindset. That means their communication, their most important thing is gone. They no longer have access to it. So I really have to ask, what would you do in their situation? You are removed. You are removed from everything that you are used to. You are removed from your cell phone to God. You no longer have access to it. What would be going through your mind? Loss. Blame. Well, I mean, if God wanted to talk to us, he wouldn't have done this. He wouldn't have thrown us into exile. If God really loved me, he wouldn't separate himself from us. Why? Why would you do this, God? Why would you take what I love away? Even in Jesus' time, when they come back from exile and Jesus is in the promised land, and I love, we read it in class, and it's John chapter 4, when Jesus has this conversation with the Samaritan woman, and he totally shifts the paradigm of what the temple is going to be. And he says, no longer will you worship on mountains, no longer will you worship in the temple. The church, the temple, God is going to dwell in your heart. So you have to understand that when they heard this, it completely destroyed their reality, because temple was everything. It was absolutely everything. So when we start in Daniel chapter 2, and if you have your Bibles, be turning over there or clicking over there. Hey, I lead Bible studies on Wednesdays and on Sunday mornings, and I think one kid brings an actual Bible. The rest, it's on their cell phones. And so there are some good qualities about this. So if you have your digital Bible, be clicking over to Daniel chapter 2. So being put in the mindset of a Jew in exile, of someone who has denied the temple of God, we're going to start reading this story. We're going to start reading how Daniel and his friends had to deal in this culture. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, he summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show you the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. Verse 6. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation." So imagine, your boss calls you into the office, and he tells you, "I have a project for you. And if you don't do this project, I'm going to kill you." You would ask, "Okay, what's the project?" What would you do if he told you, "I'm not telling. You just have to do it. Why are you still here? Do it. Do the project. I'm going to kill you if you don't do it." You'd be a little frustrated, right? To say the least. Be a little worried, especially if your boss is threatening to kill you. But this is the position that they're in. So verse 7, "They answered a second time and said, 'Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show you its interpretation.' And the king answered and said, 'I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you shall show me its interpretation.'" So what is Nebuchadnezzar asking? And I love the mindset he's in, because this is a pagan king, and even he realizes that the world holds no answers for him, that the world doesn't have what he needs. And I love to see this, because I know many, many Christians who do not have this mindset, who still look to the world for its answers. And I have to ask, before we start condemning Nebuchadnezzar for even asking the wizards and the magicians and the Chaldeans, have you ever, maybe when you were young, maybe when you were, I don't know, adventurous, have you ever talked to your pets? Have you ever done that? Have you ever, when you're maybe alone by yourself and your cat comes up and you thought no one was listening and so you just asked it a question? Maybe, and I know we all joke, but it's something I think we've all have done, and we've all have done many times. You know, you have your favorite pet, and you want to ask that pet, have you seen God? And seriously expect to get a reply from your pet? So we look at that and think, how foolish is that? I'm talking to my pet like it's a person, expecting to get answers back. But how much more foolish is it to look to Facebook, to look to the internet, to be complete? Seriously, asking Facebook, where are my friends? Why do I still feel so lonely? Asking the universe, and I love how big this is becoming in our culture, this asking the energies of the universe, why? What is my purpose? Why am I so unfulfilled? Answer me. And we get nothing back. Nothing. I love Nebuchadnezzar, because even he understands, looking to created things for spiritual answers, it doesn't get you anywhere. And he's at the end of his leash and says, "Listen, you guys cannot do this. I'm going to kill you. I'm done with this. I'm done with the world. I am done with you guys trying to explain to me. It's it. I'm done." And then later on, we're not going to read this, but later on, Daniel comes in and saves the day. He comes in and says, "King, I'm going to tell you the dream. You're going to see a statue, and this is what the statue means. And here's the head, and here's the shoulders, and this is what all of this means." And then Nebuchadnezzar understands, and he says, "Daniel, there's something more to you." And he starts to understand that not only is there a God out there, but there's a God with the answers. So this is why my topic is, where is truth? Because we always ask, and we see the conversation between Jesus and Pilate, and Pilate asks Jesus, "What is truth?" And I'm always frustrated that Jesus does not answer. Have you noticed that? He has this amazing buildup, and he's been flogged, and he's about to be crucified. And I feel like Jesus finally gets one person where he wants him, and it's Pilate. And then Pilate responds and asks Jesus, "Listen, I want to set you free, but if I do, it's going to cause rebellion. I don't know what to do. What's truth?" And nothing. Nothing. When I was really young, I was so frustrated with Jesus because he just would not say it. And I feel like the entire life of Jesus up to this point has been leading to that one question. what is truth. See, Nebuchadnezzar understands, one, that there is a truth out there. He just doesn't know where it is. He wants to know, but he needs someone to tell him. So I want to look at these two stories, one of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Abednego, as the color is, and I want to look at Daniel and the lions, because I need to sincerely ask this question. What do these stories teach me? Nebuchadnezzar says, man, the world holds no answers for me. It's fake. It's lies. They're just trying to appease me. I understand that there's nothing to this physical place. Daniel comes up and says, I'm going to open the door for you. I'm going to show you a different portal, a different reality where God not only exists, but he holds the answers. And I believe in these stories, we see some of that. So let's turn over in Daniel chapter 3. In verse 16, and there's something that you're going to have to do, and it's going to be really hard. Don't skip ahead. For some reason, and I feel like these are the most violent stories in the Bible, and we use them for VBSs, every VBS, not only as topics but also stories. And I was sitting in our VBS, and it was a great VBS, and we had a narrator, and then as this person was narrating, we had the actors acting it out. And as they were doing these stories, I'm thinking in the back of my head, these are kids. These are really graphic, violent stories. And we're teaching these to kids. And I think the only reason we do that is because we know the ending. So here's the deal. And we have to make a pact. You can't skip ahead. You have to, for the next 5 minutes, forget. And I want you guys to be surprised when you actually see what God does. Can you guys, hopefully you guys can do that. So starting in Daniel chapter 3 and verse 16. And also, I don't want to read the entire chapter, so we're kind of skipping down. Most of you, again, know this. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're in conflict with the king. Now, if they don't do what the king says, there's going to be consequences, and usually that consequences is throwing them in the furnace. And so we're right in the middle of this discussion, right in the middle of this conflict. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this manner. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I have to really add, I wonder how severe his expression changed, because the person writing this down took the time to say, oh, and then it became ugly. So you know, this is not cute. The king is getting very serious with these three. So in the middle of verse 19, he ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace was overheated, the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste, and he declares to his counselors, remember, in your logical, worldly mind, the physical, if you throw something into a furnace, what's going to happen to it? It's going to burn. It's regardless, it's going to burn. Have you ever set your hand down on a burner? What happened? Nothing? No, it burned. I want you guys to realize this is a death sentence for these guys. So back in verse 24. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste, and he declared to his counselors, did we not cast 3 bound men into the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. He answered and said, but I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. And I always want to know, I cannot wait to get to heaven. And I, in my mind, I'm imagining this like a movie, and I'm seeing this portray in front of me, and I wonder, who's in that furnace with them? Who is it? You know, was it, I don't know, was it Jesus? Was it an angel? Who is in this furnace with these guys? Whatever it is, they are confronted with the truth. Can't kill these guys. Can't do it. Verse 26, then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace, and he declared, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. Their hair, the hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. So let's real quick, let's turn over to Daniel chapter 6. Starting in verse 11. Oh, iPads. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. And they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days he is to be cast into the lion's den? The king replied, the statement is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Then they answered and spoke before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. So first, Daniel understanding what's going to happen to him if he worships and prays to God. And he does it three times a day, defying the king, asking to be thrown into this lion's den. Verse 10. Now, when Daniel knew that the document... Oh, I skipped ahead, didn't I? Verse 14. Then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king established may be changed. The king gave orders that Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, your God, whom you constantly serve, will deliver you. A stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and the signet rings of his nobles so that nothing would be changed in regard to Daniel. So remember, your view of the world, you know that if you mess with lions, you're going to get bit. Something's going to happen to you. This was a death sentence for Daniel. Now, he was not going to come out of this. Verse 18. Then the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. Then the king arose at dawn, at the break of day, and went in haste to the lion's den. And when he came near to the den to Daniel, he cried out with troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, from whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever. Daniel didn't die. Daniel did not die. That's not what's supposed to happen. If you're thrown into a furnace, you're supposed to burn. That's just what happens. If you're thrown into a lion's den, you're supposed to die. That's what happens. So what about these stories? What are some similarities? The only similarities that I can come up with is one, in both situations, they were caused out of extreme defiance towards their kings. The other one, and I think is the most gruesome, is that in each case, the negative sides, the ones that accused Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were actually punished. In Daniel's case, the satraps and the governors, the ones that accused Daniel, were actually thrown into the lion's den in their stead. And it even says that their bones were broken before they touched the ground. Not a very good kid-friendly story. And yet we teach it. So what are some differences? Besides the fiery furnace and the lions, What are some similarities? Why do we have two stories like this? Don't we only need one? The entire Bible is full of stories of God saving people out of extreme situations. I think of, well, isn't it enough to know that God split the Red Sea that the Jewish people can come across? Why more? Why more of the same stuff? I love this one truth. This is the one difference that I spot, and it's in the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel chapter 3. Even if God does not save me, I'm still not going to do what you say. Even if I die, I still choose God. Even if I suffer, I'm not going to choose you. I'm not going to choose this world. Even if I suffer, even if I die a horrific death, I'm not going to choose you, O King. I'm not going to do it. This is a truth that I want you to stow away in some part of your brain, because this is an enormous truth. It's easy to believe in God when we have a net below us. And I want to say this, it's easy for us to believe in God here in America. And the reason is we're not persecuted. It's easy for us. The government allows us to worship freely. No one was threatened with murder when they came through the building, right? That still doesn't happen, does it? It is easy for us. Yet in their situations, when they are faced with a lion, when they are faced with fire, they decided, even if I die, I'm still going to choose God. Why? Why? Why, when faced with death, would you still do that? Yet for some reason, that's their decision. I love what Jeremiah, how he phrases this. If you can, turn over to Jeremiah. This is an excellent, excellent passage. In chapter 29. And this will be the last reference. In Jeremiah chapter 29 and verse 8. For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, do not let your prophets who is in your midst and your diviners deceive you, and do not listen to the dreams which they dream. For they prophesy falsely to you in my name. I have sent them, declares the Lord. For thus says the Lord, when 70 years have been completed in Babylon, I will visit you and fulfill my good word to you, to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. Well, what about Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Where are those plans? When they're faced before the fire, when they're faced before the lions, where's the goodwill? Where's the non-persecution that I was promised, God? Where's this future that you keep talking to me about? And I love that this is coming from Jeremiah. Of all the prophets, I would never expect Jeremiah to be saying something like this. For 40 years, this man has been preaching and converts no one. How long would you work at a job and you get no friends, no appreciation, no nothing? How long would you stay at a church and be preaching if not only does your congregation hate you, but you don't convert a single person? For 40 years, this man puts up with it. And he has the audacity to say, I have a plan for you, a plan of welfare and not for calamity. So let's keep reading in verse 12. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you search for me with your whole heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and I will restore your fortune and will gather I will gather you from all the nations and from the places where I have driven you, declares the Lord. Like I said earlier, it is easy to jump when you know the net is below you. It's easy to worship God when you're not being persecuted. So what is the answer? What is the answer in all of the stories? Would you still believe in God? Would you still look to these two stories for comfort if they had different endings? If Daniel died in the lion's den, would you still read the story? Would it still be the topic of our VBSs? If Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had died in that fire, would you still look at God with confidence and say, I trust and your plan. God, you are the only answer that I need. Would you still take the leap of faith knowing that there is no net to catch you? These are happy stories because we know the end. I go to Job. I love the story of Job. Where was this future for Job? Where was the? I know that Job has a happy ending. That's the last maybe five verses of a 48-chapter book. Where's all the comfort for Job? You know, there's a book out there called The Shack. Has anyone heard of The Shack? Great book. It's a book about suffering. It's a very complicated and a very intense book. In it, this man loses his daughter, and he's called to this shack where he has this conversation with God. And as great as that conversation is, I'm constantly drawn back to Job. Where was that comfort for him? God came to Job out of a hurricane and said, "How dare you question me?" When Job lost everything, he still takes the leap and trusts God, even though there's nothing under him. He has lost everything. Would you still look to God if you know that death, imminent death, is staring you in the face? You know, I love the story. I was reading the story from Max Licato, and in this chapter, at the very end, he says, you know, just like Daniel, we need to choose God. So if you're gossiping with, you know, if you're gossiping with other ladies about your husband, you need to, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, choose God. And in my head, I'm thinking, no, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were facing death, and they chose God. Yes, you shouldn't gossip. You shouldn't be talking about people behind their back. But this story is about an intense trust in a God who has all of the answers. Now, will you be hurled headfirst into a furnace? Probably not. Will you be thrown into a dark pit, certainly to your death? Probably not. But in your life, every day, you will have to make the decision. You will be faced on your right with the world and the answers that it kind of can provide for you. Instant satisfaction, instant gratification, instant pleasure with little or to no work. No responsibilities. You can live your entire life dependent on other people and really do nothing. And on the left, you have God and His answers. That's the choice that you have to make. Knowing that if you choose the left, you may suffer. You may even die. Sure, you may live an awesome and amazing life where God looks after you and blesses you and constantly is taking care of every one of your needs. But that doesn't always happen. For every 50 of those amazing stories of Shadrach and Daniel and of the Jewish people, you have Job, who doesn't get that satisfaction of knowing why God did what He did. But do you still choose God? Do you still choose it, even if you know that there's nothing underneath you? I love the practice that we do at camps, and we have those trust falls where, for some weird reason, we're supposed to trust our friends to catch us when we fall backwards. And as we're falling backwards, we're thinking, I'm going to punch everybody if they do not catch me. And I always think, you know, I've done this 100 times, and 100 times everybody's caught me. But every time I do it, in my head, I'm thinking, what if this is the one time no one catches me? In this story, do you trust God enough to fall backwards even if He doesn't catch you? You know, there's an amazing skit about that. There's this guy playing Jesus, and he has this girl, and you can YouTube this, and he's trying to convince her to trust him, and he's trying to convince her, you know, I've got the answers, trust me, I know what I'm talking about. And the woman says, no, I don't want to. And so Jesus says, no, if you fall backwards, trust me, I've got you. And in this context, he would be saying, I have a plan. I have this purpose for you. Just trust me, fall backwards. And he's facing her. They're face to face. And so finally she goes, okay, and she turns around. And then Jesus says, no, no, no. Jesus walks around, looks her in the eyes and says, now fall backwards. And the woman looks at him and says, but there's no one. And Jesus says, no, trust me, just fall backwards. And in that skit, she says, I can't, and walks away. When armed with our questions and our answers, and knowing this, we may not always like the answers that we get from God. And we definitely may not like the way that we get those answers. When we look to God instead of this world and say, God, what is my purpose? Why am I here? Why am I not fulfilled? And instead of looking to Facebook to complete me, I'm going to look to you to complete me. And the answers that we get, we may not understand. And we definitely may not feel comfortable. But our purpose, and my challenge for you, is just like Daniel and his friends, we need to pick up our cross and follow after Christ. And as I'm saying that, I even know a cross leads to my death. A cross will lead to my death. Should we be equipped with the hearts of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Yes. But understand this, that even if God does not save you, will you choose Him? When you're in those awkward situations and you feel persecuted, when you start defending God and you feel everybody caving in on you, will you still choose God? When churches of Christ, let alone Christianity in general, when it keeps falling from its elevated state, when it keeps falling from majority to minority, when we start becoming more and more persecuted because our beliefs become more and more backwards and old school and not popular, will you still be coming here? Will you still look to God for your answers? Those are the questions that we have to ask. So I challenge you, as you keep following after Christ, keep picking up your cross, keep following in the footsteps of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and choose God, even if there's no net below you. So please, let us stand and let us sing and worship God together.
Jesus saves. Bear the news.